Well, last time we started something I kind of entitled or called Considerations on the Bible, and we left off at that point where the ancient Hebrews were beginning to develop their own alphabet and would soon have their own language. Several centuries after the death of Moses, the Hebrews developed what scholars call their earliest alphabetic form, called Paleo-Hebrew. This script will be used until about the time of the Babylonian captivity. But during that period of less than a century, while they're held captive by the Neo-Babylonians, that script is refined and forms the basis of what we call the classical or standard biblical Hebrew script that will be used from the 6th century on and is the immediate predecessor to modern Hebrew. Now, when the ancient Israelites entered the Promised Land at about the same time that this new language was emerging in a written form, Joshua led them across the Jordan River and began the conquest of Canaan. And after his death, the people were led by judges and prophets. Some scholars set that period from about 1380 to 1050 B.C. And then, as we know, a monarchy is established. And under such kings as Saul, David, Solomon, and later the great king Josiah, Israel entered its period, I think, of classical greatness, before once again plummeting as it abandoned its promises to keep God's covenant into despair, ultimately falling prey to the chipping away by the resurgent Egyptians, then the Assyrians, and then the Neo-Babylonians. And we all remember the stories associated with King Nebuchadnezzar and his attacks against them in the late 7th. And early 6th centuries B.C. Now, the period of Israel, from the judges, prophets, to the onset of the Babylonian captivity, is very crucial to the emergence of that text we call the Old Testament today. During this period, some of the Bible's most important prophets lived and wrote. Divine revelation did not end with Moses, but among the prophets of this era were Hosea, Amos, Isaac, Samuel, Nahum, Jeremiah, Ezekiel. Ezekiel himself experienced the Babylonian conquest and captivity. Now, these men participated in an arrangement that is a form of theocracy, where religion and the rulers jointly govern. Today, we are very aware of the distinction between secular rule and religious rule. I don't think any of us would advocate putting a particular preacher in control of the country today, or one particular group over another. But nevertheless, these men felt called by God to participate in this kind of arrangement of judges, prophets, and later, of course, God had promised to establish a monarchy. And that is fulfilled with the emergence of Saul, David, Solomon, and others. Now, what is important to the literature that eventually emerges is that with a written language now, they are not merely dependent upon passing everything down from one generation to another by word of mouth, the so-called oral tradition. They began to produce writings of all kinds. Some of these, of course, are the prophecies being delivered by the various prophets. Some are accounts of mundane things like trade and commerce. Others are perhaps the recordings, at least in a partial sense, of their heritage, their laws, their cultures. Now, during the monarchical era, particularly Saul and David, we have a greater degree of unity coming, David will continue that. Solomon will carry the nation to its largest territorial size. All of this is an era of greatness, accomplishments, great strides. Many things are going on. They're probably more dynamic within a defined geographical area. They have emerged at least as a regional political state. They were never a huge, powerful state in comparison to, say, the Assyrians and the Neo-Babylonians or some of the later ones like Rome and Greece. But they are a regional power. I mean, really, we are accustomed to large spaces. The United States is one of the largest countries in the world. And when we look at the so-called biblical lands, they're quite restricted. As Everett would appreciate, if you put a jet up in Israel today, how long does it take to get out of their political boundaries?
About 8 minutes.
Yeah. So in terms, we're not dealing with a huge geographical area. Now, while many advancements have been made, while many great things have been accomplished, while they're writing more, engaging in profitable trade, building the temple and all of that, they still, as they have done in the past, are pulling away from God. We have this ongoing, reoccurring cycle with God from the very beginning. To understand the Old Testament, I think you have to appreciate the destruction of Israel in the 6th century B.C. and the ensuing so-called period of less than a century we know as the Babylonian captivity. Now, Genesis chapter 13, verses 14 through 15 says, and I'm quoting now, "The Lord said to Abraham, 'Lift up your eyes from where you are and look north and south, east and west. All the land that you see, I will give to you and your offspring forever.'" Forever, however, did not turn out to be forever. The promised land that had finally been conquered after hundreds of years, beginning with Joshua's campaign and climaxing when Solomon carried the kingdom to its greatest territorial size, will fall. Shortly after the death of Solomon himself, the promised land split into two distinct political entities: the kingdom of Israel and the kingdom of Judea. The kingdom of Israel will be seized by a resurgent Assyrian empire around 722 BC. And Judea now stood alone as the Hebrew political state. Judea by herself faced ongoing competition from Egypt, a revived Babylonian empire, and the still powerful but declining state of Assyria. Now, King Josiah himself died fighting the Egyptians. And in 597 BC, the Neo-Babylonian empire attacked Judea and carried thousands, including the prophet Ezekiel and other prominent officials and people, back to Babylon. Now, there are various or multiple exodus of the Hebrews from Israel and Judea. Initially, they kind of cherry-picked the most prominent, the most productive, the most literate, the creme de creme, not the ordinary laboring person. Now, these developments, the loss of Israel, the initial attack and taking away of perhaps 8,000 to 10,000 people, created a crisis in the minds or the psychic of the Hebrew people to some degree. They began to feel abandoned by their God, and they began to despair for their futures. It is in this state of mind, particularly after the destruction of the great temple when they had rebelled, and in the final conquest about 587 B.C., that they began to search their souls, so to speak, to look inward and assess their past, their condition, proud of what they were in the immediate past, what they once were. They were now far from appearing to be God's chosen people. They were merely another conquered group in a multiracial empire, the Neo-Babylonian Empire. This spurred them, however, to inward thought and outward action. They didn't know for sure whether they would survive as a people. And they felt compelled to begin to write things down in a way they never had before. They began to put the oral tradition into a written form. They began to look at what the prophets had said, which had been passed down, or perhaps had been gathered in various scrolls. In other words, they are spurred on to produce a great deal of what ultimately becomes the Old Testament during this brief period and its aftermath. Miller and Huber, in a book I brought in last time, state, and I'm quoting now, "It was during this time of exile that the Jews compiled and edited much of the Old Testament stories and teaches into the written text we have today. Among the books polished into final form were those of earlier prophets who had warned that the nation was headed for destruction if the people did not abandon idols and evil behavior and return to God. Also finalized during this time were the books of Israel's history from Joshua to 2 Kings. Even the five books of Moses, from Genesis to Deuteronomy, were probably molded into their final form during and shortly after the exile. Collections of Psalms were probably put together during this time and formed the basis of what we know becomes the Book of Psalms. Lamentations was written at this time, giving a heartbreaking description of the fall of Jerusalem and the temple." End of quote. Now, in their exodus from Egypt, in the days in the wilderness, the years in the wilderness, periodically the Hebrews had clearly committed themselves to God to only fall away. They now, given this most recent episode in their collective existence, this falling away, this captivity, they began to look back and see their faults and their failures. They had promised to obey God, and He in turn had promised to give them land, large families, and prosperity. They had, however, not fulfilled their part of the pact, and dire consequences had befallen them. Chapter 28 of Deuteronomy clearly describes the blessings they would receive if they remained faithful and the tribulations and disasters they would endure if they failed to keep their word. Thus, their captivity, they now recognize, was merited. They got what they deserved, so to speak. Now in the hands of the Neo-Babylonians, they ask themselves this question: are we still God's chosen people? And would He ever take them back? Would He would restore them? Or had they messed it all up forever? Now, their study, however, gave them some measure of comfort. By looking closely at the traditional stories and early writings that had appeared in the last several centuries, they concluded that God indeed had been devoted to them. Yes, He would punish them for their sins and unfaithfulness, but He could forgive. He could forgive. Deuteronomy 30, verses 1 through 5, and I'm quoting the New International Version, I think sets this in place. When all these blessings and curses I have set before you came upon you, and you taken them to heart, wherever the Lord your God disperses you among the nations, and when you and your children return to the Lord your God and obey him with all your heart and with all your soul and according to everything I command you today, then the Lord your God will restore your fortunes and have compassion on you and gather you again from the nations where he scattered you. Even if you have been banished to most distant land under the heavens, from there the Lord your God will gather you and bring you back. He will bring you to the land that belonged to your fathers, and you will take possession of it. He will make you more prosperous and numerous than your fathers. End of quote. Well, he does and he doesn't. The Babylonian captivity is brief, less than a century, before it falls to what is to that date the greatest conqueror yet to emerge in the ancient Near East, the Persian Empire. And from the Persian Empire, they pass to the Alexandrian situation. So you see, they come back in certain respects because the Persians will treat them rather well, allowing them to go back to rebuild their temple and all of that. But there's going to be one conqueror after another until the time of Christ. And then, of course, the largest empire is in place then. Now, produced during this period are a number of important books, those that we commonly call the prophet, early prophets and history. Biblical scholars believe for about 2,000 years that the Old Testament, Joshua through 2 Kings, and possibly even Deuteronomy, had been written by different men at different times. In the 1940s, a biblical scholar by the name of Martin Noah made a convincing argument that these books all showed a uniform style, language, and probably had been written in a much more compacted period than previously believed, and probably by a definitive group of people. They dubbed them, these Hebrew scholars, the Deuteronomist. Beginning in Joshua's day and extending through the captivity period, these works were probably revised from their original format in light of what had happened in the captivity period. And these writers, some believe, may have been a group of Levitic priests or priests from the tribe of Levi that had moved from Israel to Jerusalem in Judea after the initial Assyrian conquest, which preceded the Neo-Babylonian contest. Traditionally, going back hundreds of years, thousands of years in some way, instances, things were attributed to that modern scholars now say that may not exactly be the case. Perhaps even more basic to what we have always viewed and accepted for generations is the authorship of the first five books of the Bible, the Pentateuch or the Torah. Those books attributed to Moses. Now, while much had been written during the perhaps late prophets, judges period, and during the reign of the early kings like Saul, David, and Solomon, it is probably still the case that most of their earliest knowledge of themselves, the creation, God, and all of that, had still overwhelmingly been passed down from father to son in the old oral tradition. Now, the Pentateuch, or the first five books of the Bible, have been attributed to whom for generations? Moses. And if you believe that, and many of you may, that's fine. I don't think it invalidates anything in there, whether Moses himself wrote them or whether someone else wrote them. I think all of that is fit for instruction and comfort and all that it does. What is a religious text supposed to do for you? Right. In other words, if you were suddenly given a charge, write a religious document, how would you begin it? Where would you begin it? I think what is in there to a great degree had been passed down. It had been talked about because they had no written language of their own. It was deeply embedded in them. And in every early culture, you have your sages, you have your prophets, you have men and women who commit an immense amount of information, and they tell their stories. We don't tell stories anymore like we used to. We've got too many other modern diversions. You know, but stop and think. For how many centuries, thousands of years, this was the way you passed information, you passed your cultural and religious beliefs.
Fred, I think there, if you believe that the Bible is the inspired word of God, then what difference does it make which man actually put a pen with a sheet of papyrus or whatever and wrote it? It was inspired by God, and God used whoever he needed to get the job done.
I think that's a good approach.
It's much like the creation that has been made in science world in the last 100 years of creation. Was it the Big Bang, or was, you know, to me the point stops at God was the one that did it. Mm-hmm. If God used the Big Bang, then God used the Big Bang. Mm-hmm. Creation, after God created the world.
Yeah.
Whether he did it in 7 days or whatever the time frame was, makes absolutely no difference. Mm-hmm. It was God who created the world.
One thing that's not, I think, appreciated enough and is this. Darwin's publication of The Origin of the Species did more to stimulate archaeological and biblical investigation than you know, it in response to that, or to it unleashed really modern archaeology, and it also entered or pushed traditional biblical interpretation and studies into a new era. A lot of good came out of that because we found a lot of supporting evidence. We found more historical proof for our beliefs through that. So, you know, science and religion, I think, aren't always at odds with one another. I think they can be very complementary to one another. Now, let me at least look at what some scholars say briefly about the first five books of the Old Testament that have been traditionally attributed to Moses. Now, Moses, in so many ways, affected that by his life that he led that we know about, and by whatever writing he may have done, because, as I noted last time, Moses is the first writer identified in the Bible. But the authorship of the first five books has been questioned since the first century AD. And in more modern times, it has been challenged, not, I think, with the intent of trying to discredit it, but to better explain it. Nowhere in the New Testament does it say outright, absolutely, that Moses wrote these five books. sometimes called the books of Moses. But that's different from saying he wrote every word in them. Now, it is true that St. Jerome, who produced the Latin translation of the Bible, we call the Vulgate Bible, which was used for 1,500 years by the Roman Catholic Church, says that Moses wrote it, but then he put a caveat, perhaps finalized about 400 BC. You know, so what I'm saying there, he's reinforcing that traditional authorship. Scholars question Moses' authorship for a variety of reasons. There are inconsistencies, contradictions. How could Moses, for example, describe his own death? And there are distinct patterns and distinct voices. In other words, who is speaking here? To whom are they speaking? How is what this one describing, while similar, yet markedly different from the other? One of the more persuasive interpretations about the ultimate authorship of these five books was presented in the 1870s by a German scholar, Julius Wellhausen, who proposed an explanation called the documentary hypothesis that is still widely used today, although many are extremely critical of it. He believed there were at least four sources, four counts, four traditions, perhaps, that had been passed down. These he identifies as the J source, the E source, the P source, and the D source. J stands for that tradition which referred to God by the name of Jehovah. E denoted that account which referred to God by the more formal name of Elah. P stands for priestly because this traditional source stresses priest and worship. D stands for Deuteronomy as a source for the books. All of these sources were originally written at different times by different people or groups and later combined or blended together to form the finished product by some unknown editor or editors. Scholars believe that the J account dates back to the 9th century. J stressed the monarchical aspects of focusing on God's promise to unite the Israelite tribes under a single king and is the simplest, most straightforward in terms of theological content, featuring God as a compassionate deity, communicating directly with his people. And it is also written in a more lively and colorful literary style. Biblical scholars believe that the E content dates back from about the 8th century and focuses more on Moses and the prophets than the kings. E's style is more formal than J's, and God is more formal and distant. After the fall of Israel to the Assyrians, E's material was taken to Judea and blended with J. The D source was largely composed of the Book of Laws that had been stored in the Great Temple. It emphasized law and temple activities and probably combined with J and E in the mid-6th century, or about that time the Babylonian captivity is taking place. P stresses roles of priests and temple worship and blended with the other sources during the period of the captivity. It also contains no references to angels or dreams. There is no mention of God mixing with humans. It also emphasizes dates, ages, and measurements. Now, you know, stop and think for a moment. One of the earliest things that biblical scholars noted were what were called doublets. In other words, two descriptions of the same event, and they did not agree. Look at the description of the animals taken by Noah onto the ark. Look at the accounts of the creation of woman. There are two different accounts of that. Now, if we accept this as the inspired word of God, regardless of what this particular one had written down from the oral tradition, and this one did, if it's all inspired by God, it's all good to use, so to speak. What is important, I think, is that whoever these men were, priests and scholars in this period, revered what they were working with. For after all, this was a huge responsibility. The need to preserve this. Look at what had recently befallen them. And in trying to bring it together, they sought not to alter it in its essence, not to delete from it or to add to it. They didn't attempt to do a massive rewrite to make it flow smoothly everywhere. And they were aware there were inconsistencies. If they wanted to heavily edit it or revise it, why not take out some of those horrible examples of their own faults and ills and sins, if you will, if they were trying to pass it on to prosperity in a way to dress it up. Now, how did they stitch it together? I'm not an editor, really. One of the ways is they often inserted genealogy and other sorts of things to bridge gaps. How do you make it move from one to another? Or to, in one book, repeat something from a previous one in order to get the flow going. The point is they saved it. And I think something along these lines is probably the closest to the truth. We don't always know everything, nor will we know anything. I think when you think realistically about it, and looking at what we know of the life of Moses, who isn't a hard documented historical figure anyway, when did he have time? As one author said, we sometimes visualize Moses as crossing the wilderness, dragging a stone, chisel in hand, writing it all down. You know, that's not very. But I keep coming back to something that I think is important. Oral tradition. They had, for a long, long time, kept their beliefs, their cultural values, their history in this way. And once the writing comes, once these men, priests and others, sensitive to their plight, sensitive to the necessity, understanding there's better storage system available now, if that had a computer that used it, if they could preserve it digitally, they would have. But they did it in the fashion they wrote it in the scrolls. Now, during the period of the captivity and after, once motivated, they continued to work, producing the Psalms, Lamentations, Chronicles, Proverbs, and then as the later prophets came along, they added those too. Now, many times we ascribe a book to a prophet, and the prophet may have only spoke it, someone else wrote it down. Or it may have been another thing that happens in this period and will exist for centuries, even into the Christian era, is that disciples often write in the name of their mentor, you know, applying what they felt their mentor was saying. It's not quite as definite as it is in our own day. Ultimately, over time, probably 6 through the 1st century B.C., the books of the Old Testament were completed and accepted as valid. They were accepted as canonical. exactly when or for what reasons or who made these decisions, we're not sure. There were also many other books that had religious ideas, stories in them that were circulated and widely read during the time, but were not accepted into what became the Tanakh or Old Testament. It is interesting to note that the 3rd century Greek translation, the Septuagint, contains some books that later were not included in a new official version of the Bible. This was done sometime after the Septuagint was completed. Now, the Jewish Bible, Tanakh, or Old Testament, is divided into 3 categories. The Law, the first 5 books of the Torah, the Prophets, which are subdivided into former and later, early prophets, later prophets, and then the Writings. It is thought by some scholars that the order of these sections reflect the sequence in which they were canonized, but I don't know that to be a fact. Now, many of these other texts that Jews were reading in the centuries immediately preceding Christ that were not accepted for inclusion into their Bible do offer us good insights into the times and conditions, state of mind, and other things going on. They were useful for the Jews themselves, and later they were read by Christians. Some of these works, which were included in the Septuagint and later in the Vulgate Bible for the Roman Catholic Church, will be dropped when the Protestant Reformation occurs. The Protestant churches decided, since the Jews had not accepted their validity, in the end, they would not. So if you pick up a copy of the Vulgate Bible, it's going to include some chapters in the Old Testament that are not in the Protestant. The Protestant Old Testament and the Hebrew Bible are the same. But the differences occur in that the Hebrew Bible consists of 24 books. The Protestant Old Testament has 39. Now, basically what happens is that the Protestant Bible subdivided some of the chapters, particularly the prophets, to broke them into separate books rather than keeping them all together. Now, some of the better known of these books that you may have heard of, but by no means all of them, are Judith, Tobit, 1st and 2nd Maccabees, the book of Sirach, which is similar to Proverbs, the book of Baruch, and, of course, an apocalyptical story or a book entitled Enoch that is in some ways similar to the Old Testament. Now, I've done the talking. Let you talk. Now, of all that I've mentioned in the last couple of presentations, what is important to remember? What can you forget before you walk out the room? I think what is important to remember is that we regard this material, regardless of how it came into being. How it came into being is not as important as to what it means to us and what it provides for us, it seems to me. How many of you love reading the Old Testament? Bob and Jim raised their hand. Well, Jim's a Psalms man, isn't he? So, you know. Yeah. Bob.
Concerned of God, they're no longer God's people. Mm-hmm. And yet,
Yeah, in other words, what if they were on God's chosen people? Why do a flip about it?
This would be post-Assyrian.
Yeah. These men, many of whom I feel had to be priests, many of whom were what we could call the intelligentsia that had emerged, wanted to be prepared should God forgive them and their conditions change, which they did when Cyrus conquered it, allowed them to go back, allowed them to rebuild the temple, that they have something out of this they could put to their future Jews and say, read this, understand this, see where we made our mistakes, you know. Plus, don't you think they're somewhat proud, despite the warts on them, so to speak? They want to keep this in a way. They have an obligation. In other words, if you don't know the past, you're bound to repeat your mistakes somewhat in the presence, I think. You know. And there's also something... these men are theologians, they're historians. They feel compelled to leave a record, I think. Why chisel your name into the tombstone after you're gone unless you want to at least someone to know you were here, you know? Now, were they God's chosen people? Yeah. But, I mean, politically, the world is, you have these reoccurring empires. But it seems to me, maybe I have the wrong idea about this. If I had to choose between the Old and New Testament, I'd throw the Old Testament away in a heartbeat. The New Testament is so different. It seems so imperative. It is the covenant under which we live. If we believe Paul, you know, he says we're you know, that sort of thing. Now, if you read it, you will find that there are different gods in the sense that the God this one talked about can be mean as a snake, and he can demand this. Another one can be loving and unfair. In other words, how he was viewed, how he acted in their mind, and all of those sorts of things. You know, we sometimes just read these as words. Oh, here's if I got to read this. You know, you read without, you know. What is the character of God in this chapter? What have the people done? Reading is a wonderful thing, but you have responsibilities as a reader. Not just pay attention to what the words are, but to think about the words and try to put them in context and to look at the total circumstances. Reading with understanding. Well, there's an intellectual understanding and there's a spiritual understanding. For better or worse, there is a holy literature regarded as holy by the people who practice it in place shortly before the appearance of Christ. And, well, I'll make this other notation. Of course, the Hebrews went to Aramaic as a part of coming back from the captivity, adopting the language of their deliverers. And then with the coming of the Hellenistic period, these writings are put into Greek. But many of the Hebrews had lost the ability to read Hebrew. So it's translated into Aramaic for them. And these are called Targums. And the question always is, when Jesus read in the synagogue, what was he reading? Was he reading out of the original Hebrew scriptures? Was he reading out of the Septuagint? Or was he reading out of a Targum, which is an Aramaic translation? It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. How much education did Jesus have? You know.
What time period was when the development of languages and
Probably the early alphabets that have application for Hebrew start about 1350, and by the time you put them in their final script, you moved up to perhaps, about 600 to 550. The classical biblical script. Now, the Hebrews produced the literature, the Old Testament. That's what we have, essentially, of that. That's the most important source of their ancient literature that we have available. Jim.
Fred, some of the things that you say, I've always wished I had time and the talent to go to a seminary and learn more about the Bible and Scripture. But one of the fears that I have about that is people trying to break down the Scripture and either make us think, well, it was written this way,
I think you're right, Jim, and what you're driving at is all of those who interpret it and do the critical analysis or the literary criticism, when somebody wrote this book, he provided a living for in the next million years for everybody who attempted to interpret it in a way he probably never intended. So what did the author really mean? Well, we have all these professors who tell us he really meant this. We don't, you know. In other words, what's important, the piece of literature or the much more voluminous criticism of it by people who are supposedly experts in it?
One follow-up question. You talk about the Old Testament. When Moses was standing in front of Pharaoh, and you're reading that story, Moses said he threw down his staff, and it turned into a staff.
Mm-hmm. There were a lot of snakes in Egypt.
But he also said they turned the water into...
Have you ever thought about this possibility? There were many gods. If you believed, even though others might not, in your world and in your mind, it functioned as a god, did it not? You know, God said, have no other gods before you, didn't he? Later on, you might say false gods. But, I mean, stop and think about that in abstraction. If you believe it, it functions in that capacity. Does it not?
But your God throws in an upset and turns in
a sin. I hope my other... Well, I'd rather have 12 babies there.